Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It is our last Friday with Scott Braddock for 2019. Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report. He is affectionately known as the Voice of Texas. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. He has actually made himself in the news as well this year. It's been quite the year for you, Bubala. That's all I have to say. And while it's our last Friday for 2019, I hope there are lots of Fridays in our future. So welcome back to the program, Scott. And this really is a good time to sort of look back at all the political chaos that's been going on. And what's so interesting to me is that the chaos in Washington really in some ways mirrors the chaos in Texas politics.
In a lot of ways, that's true. I'm watching Mitch McConnell speak on the floor of the Senate right now. The Republican leader is laying out the reasons he thinks that the Democrats in the House were wrong in the way they handled the impeachment. Of course, here we are, Arnie, in a year where, and I think It's just nuts, isn't it? It sort of works to the president's advantage.
Totally.
But everything, and here's what I mean, and I know everybody has a take on this, so I don't know that mine is any more special than anybody else. But it's sort of to the president's advantage that because everything is so insane, as you say, mm-hmm. there's always another crazy development. Mm-hmm. People aren't surprised by anything that
nothing
the president
shocks.
Does.
Nothing shocks.
Nothing shocks. There's no shock value mm-mm. to anything, really. And so the fact that the president was just impeached, which I'm interested to see how this is remembered years from now, decades from now, how will historians record what happened when Donald John Trump was impeached? Because in the moment, it didn't really feel like that big a deal. It kind of felt like, you know, if you're a Republican, you were sitting there saying, well, the Democrats were always going to impeach him. If you're a Democrat, you're saying, well, he deserves it because he does all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't feel like a big deal.
Right.
It just, I mean, at least to me, I don't know how it feels to you.
No,
it doesn't feel like
no.
a big deal. Like, it just kind of went by yesterday, and I was having dinner with some friends in Austin, and the impeachment vote was unfolding in the House, and, you know, we saw it cross on Twitter and on our cell phones, on push notifications mm-hmm. from CNN, New York Times, and everything else. The president is now impeached, and my friends and I kind of look at each other like, yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Now on to the next, you know, topic of discussion. It's just been a really crazy situation.
Well, it's, what did I say?
All year leading up to this.
Yeah. I mean, what did I say? So, what is that song with every move you make and with every what is that song? That song. But
I'll be watching.
Yeah, I'll be watching. Okay. But in a way, that's the problem. Everything he has done feels sordid, impeachable, illegal, unethical, lacking integrity. I mean, we go with the Billy Bush tapes. We go with the fact that he's now had to pay all the students he defrauded with his Trump University. I mean, and then everyone around him is spending time now wearing a jumpsuit if they worked on his campaign. I mean, the problem is that it is this sick puzzle of sordid behavior. And the problem with impeachment is that it's just one piece of this sick puzzle. So you want to be outraged, but what you're outraged about is that he got billions of dollars of free media from CNN and MSNBC and all those guys in 2016, and then to a large extent, they elevated him. He was able to trash every Republican that was running, and virtually every one of them, except for maybe Ted Cruz, was someone who was really sort of in the old camp of what we thought of as a Republican. And now we have this guy, and this guy literally is controlling the Republican Party by their balls. I'm going to use that word, everyone. I can't take it anymore. That's the only thing I keep seeing is that it's virtually all male. Okay? It's virtually all male. All the males are basically showing that they have no spine. All the males are basically saying, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir. And I'm going to be honest with you, Scott. So I've run for office.
Don't hold back, Arnie.
I don't hold. Yeah, I won't. But I've run.
No, you're saying you've got them by the balls. Don't hold back.
I know. I can't. But the reason is this: nothing is so important about re-election. What is so important is about doing the right thing. See, that's the part I don't get. These are temporary jobs. They're not supposed to be permanent. I now want term limits more now than I've ever wanted term limits in my life. I just think people need to understand this is not a job. This is a temporary public service. It's supposed to be. And I mean, just look at Mitch McConnell. How long has he been there? You know, I think he wasn't even an intern at some point in time when he was young. I mean, there's something ill about the fact is they've only sort of sucked off the government teat. And that's all they've known from their very early childhood days practically until now. And the idea of being able to sort of step away and look at the facts and exercise rational judgment is something they have no comprehension for.
The point you're making is bolstered by the fact that when President Trump was at his rally, as the as this was unfolding, where was he? He was in Michigan.
Yeah.
As this was unfolding in the House, and he reacted in real time in front of one of his large crowds, and he really, as he went into his reaction, Arnie, the thing that he stressed was that the Republicans are all united with me. You know, the Republicans are all on the same page. We've never had the Republican Party so united. And he's not wrong. I've spent the last, 10 years in Texas covering a Republican Party that cannot stop fighting with itself. The different factions of the party, all at war over social issues, bathroom bills, immigration, you name it. All of these fights that are intra-party Republican fights. And isn't it interesting that as this is unfolding and Republicans are closing ranks behind President Trump, and you've been in politics for a long time, Arnie, I've covered politics for a long time, Trump is nobody's conservative, right? He, by any definition, he's not conservative. He's something else. He's this Trump thing. With the Republican Party coalescing behind that, some of these Tea Party guys, what do they think? Well, Mark Meadows, one of the leaders of the Tea Party, head of the Freedom Caucus, says he's retiring and not going to come back. So is the Tea Party over? And are we on to something that, in a lot of people's estimation, is even worse when it comes to the Republican Party, because it was that, 35% or so of the party was sort of in this Trump camp. But guess what? While he's the president, 100% of the party has to be in the Trump camp. I was looking at the fact that you have state-level politicians in Texas, even our Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who hasn't said a whole lot about impeachment, hasn't really gone there.
He's reading the changing demographics.
I'm not sure. I'm just not sure how they think the impeachment part of this plays.
Okay.
And we were talking about the fact that this may be viewed very differently decades from now.
Mm-hmm.
When this is recorded in the history books, how's this going to play over the next 12 months as we go? Next 10-11 months as we go into the primaries and the general election. Now that this is basically done. For the Democrats, they've done in the House. They've done what they, promised their voters they would do. Go ahead and hold the president accountable, as they would say. And this was not some celebratory thing. This is something they said that they felt they had to do. It was sort of a somber thing, is the way they put it. But as we go into the election, it's this giant thing now. If you look at CNN, MSNBC, Fox News Channel, they're all talking about it 24/7. They can't stop talking about the impeachment. To the average person, it kind of goes right by, like we said. But in the campaign, is it just one of the talking points?
Right.
I mean, how big a role does this have when we actually get to the campaign? And is it just one of the marks against Trump that he was impeached? And then you have to go down the list of every other thing that he's done.
So there's a couple of things I'm thinking about, and that is I really want to go into places like Kentucky and certain rural places in Texas and say, so how's that healthcare thing doing for you? Any of you need insulin? How's the insulin thing doing? Did it make it affordable for you, or are you triaging? Do I take this shot, or do I pay the mortgage? Do I take this shot, or do I feed my family? And we talk about the fact that Wall Street is doing so well. Really? So let's look at your paycheck. How much of your paycheck is in Wall Street investments? How much? 1%? 2%? I mean, the problem is that he uses these numbers that make it sound glorious. But those numbers don't apply to real people. And what really, really scares me is that there are these very, very, very wealthy Wall Street types that absolutely hate Donald Trump. But they would never vote for anyone like an Elizabeth Warren. I'm not even going to put Bernie Sanders out there. They would never vote for an Elizabeth Warren because she talks about a wealth tax. I still want to go in front of the Tuck Business School and the Harvard Business School and all the business schools in the country that have created these multi-billionaires, of which we have way too many today, and ask them, so when are you rich enough? No. I want to know. When are you rich enough? Because you are so afraid of losing a billion of your 55 billion? That's okay. Bloomberg's going to spend probably a billion just running for president. And he probably got that in the tax cut. I want to know the question because I know when I'm poor enough because I'm on the street. That's the difference. I'm on the street. I'm living with cockroaches. I can't afford Cobra. I've lived all those lives. This is the killer for me. I have lived without health care. I have lived with cockroaches. I know what it's like to be on WIC. I know what it's like to be so afraid about what you're going to do. I'm lucky today. There's no question. And interestingly enough, it was my wealthy aunt that left it to me. My wealthy aunt never gave me a dime until she died, which is sort of interesting. And so I'm very lucky. But all of us don't have a wealthy aunt. Most of us don't. We live in a permanent cycle of struggle. And it's getting worse and not better. And that's why I want to go to Harvard Business School and ask the question, when are you rich enough?
And, you know, all this happens, Arnie, right as the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans struck down the Affordable Care Act's requirement that Americans carry health insurance, but sidestepped the ruling on the overall constitutionality. But this was a case that was brought by the Attorney General in Texas, Ken Paxton, who is still fighting tooth and nail the ACA, Obamacare. As that ruling came down this week, I saw where some Democrats in Texas, including some state representatives, were thanking the Attorney General for once again putting health care front and center for the 2020 election cycle. You do have backlash to quote-unquote Obamacare in Texas, as we saw over the ever since it was passed,
but not to pre-existing conditions,
however,
not to including your kids on insurance. Just remember,
that's right. However, in recent cycles, now that he's not president anymore, it's more difficult to run against the specter of Barack Obama, and I've seen this in policy discussions at the Texas Capitol. A couple of sessions ago, there was a 4 years ago or so. You had discussions about trying to put more money into the program that reimburses families who need care for their acute care therapy children. We're talking about fragile children, epileptic seizures, kids who need to learn how to swallow, things like that, and live in rural parts of the state where the only answer is a reimbursement from Medicaid. Anything that had to do with Medicaid was viewed as something to do with Obamacare, even if it had nothing to do with it. But the word Medicaid, because of Medicaid expansion, that's what people think in their head when they hear the word Medicaid, there would be instant rejection of whatever the idea was, if it had to do with putting more money into Medicaid or increasing reimbursements. The tide has shifted on that, where it's not a dirty word anymore to talk about Medicaid. Some of this funding was restored in this last legislative session. It was a priority of Republicans. And when I would talk to them privately, they would say that anything to do with Obamacare, ACA, anything like that. So
we're not going to remind them. And we're not going to remind them.
We can sort of talk about health care again, around here. So I'm wondering, as this moves to the forefront once again, and as it is one of the main issues of the Democratic Party, as they seek to regain the White House, as they seek to take the Texas House, et cetera, how that issue is going to play now that you don't have Barack Obama as the president, and
it's not Obamacare.
And you don't have the fact that Democrats are just not voting in Texas anymore. Now they are. In 2018, all these new Democratic voters showed up. So it's interesting that people still sort of give it, just sort of take for granted that the electorate in Texas leans to the right. I'm not sure that it does after the election in 2018. There were 500,000 people who voted for Beto O'Rourke and then voted for Greg Abbott. I don't know if those people are more conservative or more liberal and what exactly they're basing their votes on.
Well, they clearly don't like Ted Cruz. I mean,
that's true.
Let's do the messaging.
Right. But we will definitely have a real test of whether that's a trend or not in 2020 without Beto O'Rourke on the ticket, but with President Trump at the very top.
Well, one of the things, so we were talking actually about Texas the other day on my radio show because we were talking about the show.
Without me?
Without you. We're talking
Shame
about the show. Oh, I know. Tisk, tisk. But we were talking about the shutting down of rural hospitals, that rural hospitals cannot survive. And what does that mean? That means people are now having to travel 100 miles to get to a doctor, or they have to travel 120. But one of the things about Medicaid, and you did not do Medicaid expansion, you have the highest number of uninsured in the United States. I would love for people to start running in 2020 and with the word Medicaid, and then show where most of the Medicaid dollars go: to your grandma, to your grandpa, your old uncle, and your old aunt. Most of Medicaid dollars go to old people in nursing homes. And do you want to throw them under the bus? Do you not? And here's the kicker. If you do, you're responsible. Because you won't let your grandmother die on the street. But if you have to take care of your grandmother, what income do you give up? What bedroom do you give them? What kind of nursing skills do you have? People need to connect these dots. They hear Medicaid and they automatically assume some sort of welfare queen, you know, with three little kids.
Cash in a check.
Exactly. Cash in a check. And the irony here is that so many of those dollars are going to old people. And you and I both know we have an aging demographic. And not only do we have an aging demographic, but what is the statistic that white people especially are dying younger today than they were before? They're dying sicker today, which means guess what? They need Medicaid even more today because they're going to be ending up in some kind of a nursing home being cared for to their twilight years. So this is the problem, is we don't understand what in fact we're paying for.
It shouldn't be a problem. It's interesting, Arnie, that you have politicians who are so afraid of certain things, even when it's been proven that they shouldn't be. So in the Republican primary in 2018, there were attacks against incumbent Republicans in the Texas House because they had voted to set up a fund that it was connected to Medicaid, and I won't get into all the details of it, but it's what you said. They were trying to improve the level of care that the elderly receive in nursing homes around Texas. And they had voted for this, and guess how they were attacked? By dark money groups, including Power Texans and others, ones that we've talked about many times. Mail pieces were showing up and radio ads, et cetera, attacking these Republicans for having supported a, quote, granny tax. They're trying to tax your granny and all this. And but the thing was, those Republicans who were attacked that way, I might be wrong, I might be off by one, but I believe every one of them won their race anyway.
It didn't matter.
Yeah. Because people understood that, one, it was a bogus attack, but two, that they didn't mind putting money in for that. In fact, the fact that they were being attacked, these Republicans were being attacked for that, you know, they used it to bolster their campaigns. They said, look, what we're trying to do is try to improve the quality of care for people who are our grannies, grandpas, et cetera, and this is just a silly deal. But, you know, you will always have those who will continue to be afraid if they were branded as supporting some new tax, even though that wasn't true at all. And, in fact, when polling was done on this among Republican primary voters, they were fine with taxing a little bit more, you know, to be able to pay for that specific service.
So let's look at Texas for 2019.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Let's take a look at what happened, because it did feel so chaotic in a way that I've been looking at the chaos of Congress and of Washington. But because of you, I have to focus on what's going on in Texas. And I'm just curious, you've been covering Texas politics for a long time. Did this year feel quirky, like different, like a little more unstable than normal?
A year of contrast, Arnie. In the beginning of the year, you remember, for about 5 months, we talked about a legislative session that was, to put it nicely, was boring.
Uh-huh.
That was the intent of the Republican leadership. They wanted it to be boring. They wanted it to be focused on, meat and potatoes issues, none of the red meat. Let's just focus on what? On school finance and property taxes. Followed school finance and property taxes. Nothing else. That's all they wanted to talk about. The governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker were all focused like a laser on that.
Yeah.
And then the contrast, of course, was as soon as the legislative session was over, and the speaker and the governor and all of them had declared this was the Super Bowl of sessions. This is the best legislative session we've ever had. The newly minted speaker, Dennis Bonin, who succeeded Joe Strauss in the chair, Bonin melted down.
Yeah, completely.
He tried to cut this deal with Empower Texans, the dark money group. This is so surreal, of course, to talk about it now, but he offered in a private meeting that was secretly recorded. Later, we all heard the tape, and the evidence came out that he had targeted me. He was going to take my media credential away. As
God,
a
I so love you, Scott Braddock.
He was going to give media credentials to Empower Texans to be able to be on the floor of the Texas
House. A dark money group, everyone. Empower Texans, a dark money group
that contributes millions of dollars to Republican candidates, to elect or defeat candidates in elections, that he was going to allow for that. And he was, and by the way, he was also plotting against members of his own party saying that, you know, this group in Power Texans should spend their money against specific Republican members of the Texas House. And that was after Bonin had, for months, talked about the idea that members of the House didn't need to, should not, and he would punish them if they did, get involved in the races of other House members. So he was duplicitous. He was a liar.
So let me just say something. Is there something
over the top, by the way, he is on the cover of Texas Monthly.
Oh, good.
New edition coming out.
Really?
Every year they do something called the Bum Steers of the Year. It's a long-standing tradition. Cover now. Bum Steers are Beto and Bonin. You may have sabotaged your political careers, but you've won our election in a mudslide.
Beto.
And it's got Beto and Bonin there. The feeling on Beto with them is that he started out the year with so much promise and just crashed and burned. And both of these guys, by the way, and I'm, you know, people always have opinions about this you know, this award and this list, Arnie. It's kind of like when Rolling Stone puts out the, you know, the list of the best rock songs. People just argue about that. But with Beto, it is interesting that he did start the year at, you know, with a cover of Vanity Fair, Born to Run, and all of that, and just completely flamed out on the campaign trail. And didn't run for the U.S. Senate when polling showed that Texas Democrats wanted him to do that. The polling that I saw, I think some of this was public, if I remember right. I think there was one public poll that showed 60% of Texas Democrats wanted him to come back and run for the Senate. There was private polling that tracked with that as well that I saw. And no, he did not want to do that. You know, now he's focused on trying to help down ballot candidates. He's, you know, he said he's going to be campaigning for Democrats around the state as they try to take back the majority in the Texas House of Representatives, which actually may be
a nice thing.
It may actually be an effective role for him. I do think that because of some of the positions he took on the campaign trail, trying to win the White House, trying to move the needle in the primary, I think he probably did himself some damage with voters back here in Texas. I mean, remember, when you're talking about
gun
confiscation, that plays one way in some other places. I was telling some national media outlets just the other day because they were asking about a race in South Texas with South Texas Democrats, and South Texas is very Democratic, Arnie. But that's a different kind of Democrat than what you have in the Bronx, right?
I know that.
A Democrat in South Texas, if you're talking to them about guns, the question is not do you support more gun control or not. The question is how many guns do you own? A lot of these folks they would describe themselves as pro-life. They're probably not for gay marriage. They're probably very supportive of the oil and gas industry, and they're probably not very receptive to the idea of the Green New Deal and all of that. So it's just a very different reality when you're trying to run for office in Texas and run statewide. But if Beto can be effective in helping some of these Texas House candidates in the areas of the state
where he's
still sort of considered a rock star, particularly in the suburbs, it's probably a better place for him to be.
So I'm listening to your Bum Steer Award, and it was Beto and the speaker. I'm looking at New Republic, and you know what they have? They have the Scoundrel of the Year Award. And who gets the Scoundrel of the Year Award at the New Republic? Rudy Giuliani. And, of course, I was depressed, and I went, only one? So, you know, it's been a very toxic year for everyone. But let me just say something. I've been thinking about this. So your speaker got into trouble because he was trying to shake down the Empower Texans in order to get rid of 10 of his Republican, maybe more moderate legislators. And he wanted to basically sell your press pass to them. Doesn't that feel a lot like what Donald Trump did with the Ukrainians?
There's so many parallels. You had
this is unfreaking believable. Shakedown is us. Shakedown is us.
Yeah.
Go on.
For months, we were hearing just secondhand information about both of these conversations.
Yes.
We hadn't. You know, no one had heard. You know, direct from the horse's mouth exactly what had happened in this Bonin conversation. It was secret. You know, secretly recorded. So we ended up hearing it eventually. With Trump, they put out that memo from the White House, which basically confirmed the outline of the story. But the president, of course, you know, insists that nothing was wrong. But, you know, it really was the plotting against members of his own party, I think, that that did Bonin in eventually. And, you know, when the tape came out, it was game over. He was, you know, he could not recover, especially after making so many false statements before the tape was released. The tape also just proved that he was lying about it the entire time.
Exactly.
But I do want to make one point real quick, Arnie. I know we're probably coming close to
the
end here. But I would say this. The big story that people should focus on when it comes to what took down the Speaker of the House, it's, you know, what leads to the duplicity, what leads to trying to cut a deal with a group like this, it's dark money. It's corrupting to the system. The reason he's afraid of them and wants to make a deal with them is because they hide who their donors are. Right. Nobody knows, you know, where all these millions of dollars are coming from to try to defeat or elect candidates in Republican primaries. And so he feels the need, Bonin felt the need, to try to cut some sort of peace accord with them.
Exactly.
Guess what? These people are like political terrorists. You don't negotiate.
Political terrorists.
Folks.
And on that note, I have to say that in a lot of ways, I'm going to tell you something else. Donald Trump and Putin. That's how it feels. It
you
feels
don't
like
negotiate
had,
with them either.
Right. Well, exactly.
Russia,
exactly. And that is exactly the same thing as Empower Texans. What is not exactly the same thing is that they are not lucky enough to have you on the air with them every week. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is known as the voice of Texas. It is our last show of 2019. I hope there are shows ahead of us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Peace through strength, Arnie.
Peace.
Talk soon.
All right. Talk soon. All right, everyone. Stick around. A little bit about New Hampshire and presidential primary politics.
Gardens growing clean water on this current cast. When it rains, the runoff picks up pollution. Fertilizers, herbicides, and oils are carried across hard surfaces, through drains, and into our rivers, lakes, and oceans. Now people are creating rain gardens, directing storm water runoff to shallow depressions in the landscape where it's held long enough to seep into the ground. Pollutants are filtered out or broken down as they move through the soil and into the groundwater supply. With native plants, a rain garden can be a beautiful, low-maintenance, and low-cost way to attract birds and butterflies, too. Your garden may start in the gutter, but it can end up bringing clean water and new life to the land. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. We've talked to him a number of times. I've done WGBH radio with him a number of times. His name is Paul Steinhauser, and Paul Steinhauser is covering the presidential primary in New Hampshire for virtually everybody. I mean, I don't know how you have a life, Paul, because you are covering every campaign. You're following the polls. You're talking to people like sort of behind the scenes. So we're at the end of 2019. And actually, this is where I want to begin. How has it changed? How have the crowds changed? How has the relationship changed? Have you noticed anything different from when you started, probably sometime before the summer, and what we are seeing now as we enter this sort of final night? We're taping the show on Thursday. Tonight is the final big debate. Then there'll be an Iowa one and a New Hampshire one. But what are you seeing different in how the candidates are sort of sorting themselves out?
I know, it has been such a long road, really. I mean, remember, this race for the White House started a year ago. Remember,
exactly.
Julia Castro jumped into the race in late December of last year. Elizabeth Warren announced on New Year's Eve day. And most of the other candidates jumped in the winter and early spring. So
thank you for reminding me.
This has been going on for quite some time now.
It has. Well, you know, I keep trying to tell people the thing that's so exhausting in New Hampshire is at the beginning we had like over 20 candidates, and people feel this like obligation to sort of check out all the 20 candidates. The problem is we always do these things where we do it more than once. Well, I don't have enough time between making dinner and putting the kids on the bus and seeing all these candidates. And on top of that, we're sort of trying to follow what's going on in Washington because it's like so crazy with Mueller and with the impeachment. It feels like in some ways they are being forced to compete with these crazy political atmospherics that make it difficult to sort of focus. Am I wrong or am I wrong?
No, you're not not at all. I mean, the race for the White House should be the top story right
exactly.
now, right, in New Hampshire and nationally, but it's not. Impeachment obviously is the top story right now. And the primary campaign is kind of battling for attention, with the, for media time and more importantly for the time of voters who,
right.
as you say, voters only have a limited amount of time, most of them, they can spend thinking about this stuff. And well, when they do, a lot of that thought right now is going to the battle down in Washington, D.C. over President Trump and his impeachment. The other thing, and you mentioned it, is just the size of the field. We've never seen anything like this before.
No.
The record was 4 years ago when the Republicans had 18 contenders going at it for their nomination. This time around, the Democrats, they topped out around 25, which is just mind-boggling. 25 candidates.
That's incredible.
We've never seen anything like that. 18 was enough.
Yeah.
25. We're down to 15. That sounds pretty good, but that's still a lot of candidates. 15 presidential candidates are still in the race. Seven, the top seven in polling and fundraising, made that debate this week. But that's still a lot of candidates, and you're right. For New Hampshire voters who like to, tout that they won't make their mind up when it comes to the primary until they've seen the candidates two or three or four times and had a chance to talk to them directly,
right.
Well, that's not easy when you've got that many candidates, Arnie.
Exactly, exactly. And while last night was the vote on impeachment, there was one candidate who stuck out from that vote. Tulsi Gabbard voted present on both articles. So,
yep.
I mean, this is her last hurrah. She used the impeachment vote to sort of bring attention to herself. It'll be really interesting to see how people respond to her rationale for doing that. I mean, I'm just it's somewhat mind-boggling, but again, Tulsi has been mind-boggling throughout this entire campaign because to a large extent, it's funny, Bernie Sanders runs against the Democratic Party, although he caucuses with the Democratic Party, and he wants the Democratic Party to be maybe a little more progressive and responsive to working people. Tulsi runs against the Democratic Party because she totally wants to see it, I think, to some extent, destroyed. So it's so interesting. And then to see that vote last night, I'm like, whoa, that was an exclamation point.
I wasn't surprised. She has voiced displeasure with impeachment for quite some time. She was the last presidential candidate to say publicly that President Trump deserved to be impeached. In her statement explaining her vote, she said that she believes, he deserves to be impeached, but she didn't like the way the House Democrats were doing it and that it was too partisan, and she didn't think a partisan impeachment would be healthy for the country. But this is, will it hurt her? It may hurt her with some voters because almost every Democratic primary voter thinks that the president should be impeached. But her supporters, a lot of them, and I've gone to a lot of her events, she's got a distinct type of support. And it comes from a lot of former Republicans and independents as well. So I think for any other Democratic presidential candidate, doing what she did would be the death knell. For her, maybe not, because, again, her base is not a traditional Democratic Party base.
Well, let me just say something. You mentioned Republicans. So should I tell you about the emails I get from Republicans that ask me, well, you want to go with me? I'm going to go see Tulsi. You want to go with me? I'm going to go see Tulsi. Mm-hmm. And these are Republicans. No Democrat has actually said to me, you want to go with me? It's been all my Republican friends, which I think is like, okay, now explain that to me. And let me just say something else. I understand that she thought that the House was too partisan. She's been around Washington now for a while. Tell me what's not partisan about Mitch McConnell. Tell me what's not partisan about how these boys are operating in the Congress. It has been the most volatile, partisan, acrid. And what does she want? She wanted people to change? She expected them to suddenly have this kumbaya and say, of course, here's a witness. Oh, of course, we want to hear all the testimony. Of course. I mean, they talked about process because they wanted to set the process up to fail. You don't have a right to talk about process when you screw the process. And for her to do this, can I just say something? I want to talk to Tulsi. It shows that she doesn't have a spine. Because I think what she did was sort of, in a way, thread a needle. But the needle isn't a needle of leadership. The needle is, oh, it wasn't just the way I wanted it. It was too partisan. And I'm going, really, where have you been? I mean, I've been to Washington, and I'm watching it, and I'm thinking, what ain't partisan there? I mean, even which bathroom you use is partisan. So that, to me, seems like a weak response.
Well, you're absolutely right in that, you know, everything in D.C. nowadays is partisan. And, you know,
disgusting.
It's been 20 years since the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, where we did see some Democrats and some Republicans go the other way and cross party lines on the vote. Mm-hmm. We're not going to see that this time.
No,
we obviously didn't see it in the House vote this week,
where
every Republican stood in line behind the president out of fear in some reasons, for some cases. And almost every Democrat, I think there were three who voted against impeachment, separate from Tulsi Gabbard, who voted just present, three voted against impeachment. One of those, a congressman from New Jersey, is now going to become a Republican.
Right.
So the Democrats held their line very strongly as well, especially, you know, Democrats in some tough districts that went for Trump in 16 decided to impeach him. But for Gabbard, again, though, I just don't think this will hurt her that much.
No, I get her base. I get her base.
Traditional Democratic voters.
Yes, yes, yes. All the Republicans are just singing like happy campers, and they're all I'll probably get three more invitations to go see Tulsi. So I'm not even worried about that. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what is happening. You had a 603 post where you mentioned that Bernie Sanders had the biggest event this cycle in Nashua, New Hampshire. So explain to me Bernie's sort of resurgence or reconnection and what is happening to Elizabeth Warren. And let me just say something. I noticed something very cryptic. So a friend of mine who I speak to all the time, a very progressive guy from Connecticut, big Warren person. Guess what he did about a week ago? He said, well, we really need to talk about Sanders and Warren. I went, wait a minute, Sanders and Warren? Not Warren and Sanders? Just the flip of the way he framed it, said to me, and I called him on it. I said, Bill, what's this, Sanders and Warren? You were the biggest, you know, happy camper when it came to Elizabeth Warren, and now you seem to be more receptive to Bernie and more willing to even sort of put him up the flagpole first. So tell me what you're seeing.
Times have changed. Well, first of all, you know, give him a little credit in that maybe he went alphabetically, right?
Becomes
before W. Times have changed. Listen, in the summer, Warren was on the rise. In the autumn, Warren was on the rise. And Sanders, his star had been eclipsed in many ways by Warren in the battle for the progressive base of the Democratic Party. That's all changed in the last month now. It started when Warren, in the last debate in Atlanta, was getting a lot of heat over Medicare for all. This is all about Medicare for all, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some criticism when she came out, A, with her plan on how she would pay for Medicare for all, and B, on the implementation.
Yes.
And a lot of progressives.
She wasn't going to do it in 24 hours. She's going to do it in 4 years. I want to know anything that's ever been done in 24 hours. I want to know any president who's been able to change, 70% of the total economy and do it in under a year, in under 2 years. I mean,
I'm just explaining what happened.
I know.
And that criticism has mounted, and you've seen a deterioration in the polls. It's been very clear. National polls, obviously, but more importantly, polling in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states that vote, Warren has dropped. Sanders has risen. He's clearly now number two behind Joe Biden, who remains the front runner nationally and is part of that top tier in the early voting states. She's been eclipsed by Bernie Sanders, just like she eclipsed Bernie Sanders back in the spring and summer. So it's kind of flipped back and forth.
So I'm kind of curious though about this, because I think one of the things Elizabeth Warren can remind everyone is that if Bernie was such a purist on Medicare for All, and I'm a big Medicare for All supporter, let me just say this: I've been that way since the early 1990s. Okay, mm-hmm. this has been a defining issue for me. But Bernie voted for the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act was a compromise. The Affordable Care Act moved something. If he was so a purist, he would have said, oh, no, it's not my Medicare for All. You arrested the doctors who tried to bring up Medicare for All. There is no public option. This sucks. No. He knew that it would expand something. It would tweak something. So my dear Bernie Sanders, who I totally adore and I've known him for 30 years, please explain to me why you were willing to compromise when you were a senator, and what makes you think you will not compromise as a president, because I think you're in la-la land. I mean, the last time you were a solo performer was when you were mayor of Burlington. I mean, this is where, in a lot of ways, people don't understand politics and policy and the idea of compromise. And you know me, Paul, I've been doing this for a long time, but I started, you know, with, you know, over nearly a decade of working in the New Hampshire legislature that was totally controlled by Republicans. And I hate to break it to you, I was effective.
That's, you know what, if I was the Warren campaign right now, I would hire you immediately, bring you down to Boston,
exactly.
And get you on the payroll.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, that's exactly what she needs to be doing. You know, she needs to pick, and she started to do this, but she's been doing it more with Biden and Buttigieg, and that is paint contrast. She's
yes.
been doing it much more effectively this month.
Yep.
But the real person she needs to paint contrast with are not them, because, well, Buttigieg to a degree is threatening her with especially with upscale voters. But the person she really needs to be, you know, criticizing and painting contrast with is Bernie Sanders.
Well, so I said this morning. I do a show with a guy from Texas, Scott Braddock, who's just fantastic, just like you, Paul. He's also fantastic. And one of the things we talked about is that this is my dream. My dream is to walk into every business school in America that creates the billionaires that we now see, whether it's Harvard or Tuck or whatever, and ask them the question, when are you rich enough? Because I understand that the high-end wealthy voters are concerned. Most of Elizabeth Warren's taxes don't touch you unless you are, like, ridiculously wealthy, unless you own at least 7 houses, drive 12 Maseratis, and probably have a place in Aruba. I mean, we're not talking about rich people. People don't even get how rich we are today. That's the other thing, Paul. You've seen Elizabeth Warren more than I have. You've seen Bernie Sanders. I mean, people don't even understand. The kind of rich we're talking about didn't exist 15 years ago. They didn't even exist. They are some now uber rich, that what she is talking about really says more about what's happened to your income. It's gone all the way up to the rich. And these people are afraid. Even the rich are afraid. I'm sorry, but I want to go into Bedford and say, really, what do you have to give up?
I hear you. I hear you, Artie. And I think a lot of voters also hear what you're saying, and on the progressive side, and feel the exact same way. Listen, that's been a cornerstone of both of their campaigns, and that will continue to be.
What are they doing? What are they doing about impeachment, though? So how are they going to thread this needle? They're going to debate tonight. We're taping the show every one Thursday morning. I apologize. But the last debate of 2019 is happening tonight. And I'm just trying to figure out how they're going to address it, because in a lot of ways, they want the people to fire Donald Trump. They really do. They want to give people reasons to fire. And impeachment is just one of the fingers on the hand. There are so many reasons to fire him. But then they want people to hire them. How are you hearing them talking about impeachment? How is Mayor Pete talking about impeachment? How is Biden talking about impeachment? I mean, Biden, of all the people, has to be terrified if they actually bring in witnesses, because he better have a long conversation with Hunter.
Yeah, so that is a possibility that, you know, if the Democrats get their way and
yes.
you get a lot of these top White House officials,
yes.
like Chief of Staff Mulvaney, yeah, that then Biden. But I don't think that's going to be happening. I think Mitch McConnell said pretty clear there's not going to be witnesses at this trial. And I don't know how, you know, the minority, Senator Schumer, really doesn't have the power to change that. The Democratic presidential candidates are pretty much uniform, other than Tulsi Gabbard,
right.
Who's not on the debate stage. She didn't make that debate,
right.
And that's something else we can talk about, who didn't make it.
Yes,
but,
anyone of color, except for Andrew Yang.
Right, exactly. That's a big storyline
right.
for the Democrats. But yeah, but they're mostly in uniform when it comes to the impeachment of President Trump. And what they talk about more is not impeaching Trump, and more about what happens after Trump leaves the White House.
Right.
And, you know, what their plans are to get the country, A, back on track, and then, B, move it more forward towards more progressive, you know, a goal. So that's what you hear. And voters don't, some people are surprised when I tell them this. It's not like when you go to a campaign event that you hear all about impeachment. You don't.
Yeah.
It doesn't come up that often. It's already baked into most Democratic primary voters.
Right.
They want him out. They want to know what you, the candidate, will do if you get in. More, that's more important to these candidates, these voters here in New Hampshire.
So what about climate change? You know, between health care and climate change, I see those as the two big issues. And the question is, I guess, how do you interpret urgency? You've heard Mayor Pete a lot. Mayor Pete packages young so that just by his youth, therefore, he'll be different. But the more I hear from him, he sounds pretty much like a younger Biden. So I'm just trying to figure out, how is Mayor Pete addressing climate change, given the fact that we're looking at the urgency of the situation, and every single scientist that predicted something 10 years ago basically has now signed on to papers that say, I screwed up. It's worse than I thought. So the problem becomes, whoever's the next president, it's going to be on their watch, then worse than I thought is going to happen. I mean, I hate to break it to you.
No, and again, this is another issue where the Democratic presidential candidates are pretty much, again, on the same page, A, for criticizing Donald Trump, for basically ignoring climate change, and B, all talking about the need, the immediate needs to reduce our carbon footprint. They've got different goals. Some are 2040, some are 2030, some are 2050 on getting the U.S. off of a carbon footprint and moving to a clean energy economy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all, you know, there's change, there's differences in how they'll get there, but they've all got the same goal. Some of the candidates make it a bigger issue than others. Remember Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, when he was in the race, he was a one-issue candidate. It was all about climate change.
Right.
But right now, I think the two that are talking about it the most, and it's the biggest part of their campaigns, are the two billionaires, actually. Tom Steyer, who's been an environmental advocate for a decade now. It's a key part of his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And also Michael Bloomberg, who we will not be seeing here in New Hampshire. Obviously, he's skipping the early voting states. But Bloomberg, for the last decade, has also poured millions and millions and millions of his own money into climate change, into combating climate change. Just had a big, completely laid out his plan. But again, all the candidates this is not a divisive issue in the primary. It'll be a very clear and divisive issue in the general election when you've got a Republican nominee, most likely Trump, clearly against taking serious actions to combat climate change.
So I haven't been able to find out this yet, but on Thursday night will be the debate. I am kind of curious as to how many minutes Mayor Bloomberg is going to buy in TV ads during the debate. So he will, in a way, he will be on the debate stage without being on the debate stage. He'll be able to give his message without having to be attacked. He'll be able to deliver whatever it is he wants. I mean, in a brilliant way, because he does have $55 billion. And that's a lot of money, everyone. I just want everyone to know that. And even when we hear about the fact that he's been so philanthropic when it comes to, you know, investing in climate change and investing in gun issues, don't forget, these are nonprofit contributions. We help him pay for that. He gets to write that off his tax liability. So we're actually paying almost a third of what he's doing. So don't feel like, oh my God, St. Mike. I mean, St. Mike has had, you know, the U.S. actually helping him make these investments. And then when you look at the tax cuts, he probably is swimming in cash because of what he did for the corporate taxes and the personal taxes. So I'm kind of curious, has anyone yet checked? I would love to look at, I know, where is this debate going to be? Who's running the debate? What station?
I'm glad you asked. Bloomberg's campaign whether they're doing this. I haven't heard back from them yet.
That's the most important question, everyone. Start asking. Keep going.
The debate is being held in Los Angeles.
Right.
It's going to be it's a PBS Politico debate, so it'll be broadcast on television on PBS on your public broadcasting stations across the country, and it'll be simulcast on CNN. They have no editorial input in the debate, but so you got two places to watch it, on broadcast TV, on PBS, and on cable, on CNN. Now, it's interesting you mentioned Bloomberg. Somebody else I know for sure will have ads up there. Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, who failed for the first time to qualify for a debate as they raised the threshold.
Right.
He's going up with his first TV ads of his entire campaign tonight. They're going to run in the early voting. There are 22 markets across the country. That includes all four of the early voting states, as well as a lot of big cities like New York, L.A., Washington, D.C. And this ad, which is pretty comical and pretty interesting, will run in the debate. So voters watching on TV. We'll see Cory Booker, even though he didn't make the debate stage. As for Bloomberg, a good question. I don't have an answer for you.
We got to start doing the math. All right, before I let you go, NBC called me the other day, and they're asking me about Deval Patrick. And I was a bit of a jerk. And when the reporter comes with the camera crew, I started by saying, Deval who? And I guess I'm curious, what are you hearing about Deval? Have you heard him?
Yeah, I've seen Deval a bunch of times. He's been up here about four or five times. In fact, about an hour from now, we're taping this, recording this on a Thursday. I'm going to cover Deval Patrick. He's okay. Going to be talking policy in Manchester. So he's been up here a lot. My question to him, though, is does he have the urgency right now? He's started to put together a team here in New Hampshire. They've got a state director and a few other staffers. It just, and they're doing the same in South Carolina and I think to a lesser degree in Iowa, but it just doesn't seem like he's got the urgency, and he needs to have it.
No.
We're 7 weeks away from Iowa, 8 weeks away from New Hampshire. He needs to kick this into high gear immediately, and it doesn't seem like he's done it yet. He's obviously not registering in the polling yet, neither here in New Hampshire or nationally. I'm going to give him a few more weeks, but after that, you're out of time, Deval Patrick.
Right, that's exactly what I said.
Immediately.
Exactly what I said. I said, here's his problem. His problem is it's a very short period of time. What's his message? What's his money? What's the urgency? Why Deval? You know, why not Corey? Why not some of these other people who have already been slugging away? And I'm trying to figure out how he distinguishes himself compared to the other candidates and what is the redeeming value that says, oh, of course, Deval, other than he's a good friend with Barack Obama. But then again, you got Joe Biden, you know. And last but not least, Donald Trump, they just fired their New Hampshire campaign manager. What's wrong with this campaign manager? Was he too reasonable? Was he not, like, you know, body-checking people? I'm just trying to figure out what was it about the campaign manager that got people somewhat disgusted because they felt somewhat disorganized?
Here's what my sources in Trump world here in New Hampshire are saying. A, the guy was very young. B, he had no New Hampshire experience, and that was
exactly.
The real beef.
Yeah.
A lot of the team from 2016 that, give them credit, you may not agree with them, they did an amazing job here in New Hampshire, you know, propelling Trump to victory in the primary and then almost winning the state in the general election, just lost by about 3,000 votes. But they feel, to a degree, like they're being shut out a little bit, that all the staffers are from out of state.
Right.
And I think those concerns were finally heard by the bosses down in Washington, D.C., because let's be honest, this campaign is being run much more centralized this time by Brad Parscale down in Washington, D.C. So I think the message was heard loud and clear, the complaints from New Hampshire. You got to change a leader. You will soon have a change of leadership here in New Hampshire.
So has anyone talked to Chris Sununu about what he thinks about Donald Trump and the impeachment? Have we been able to thread that needle? Because he was a big supporter of Donald Trump, and he even told us that there were busloads of voters, illegal voters from Massachusetts that came across the border to vote against Donald Trump, although for some reason, why'd they vote for him? Anyway, I'm just kind of curious, how is Chris Sununu threading this needle? This is a moderate Republican state or a libertarian Republican state. I know so many Republican chairmen that are not, they're never Trumpers. They're forming the Lincoln Party. They're doing all these things. There is still a group of Republicans that are at the base and heart of this party that are like so disgusted. So how does Sununu like be who he is, recognizing that everyone else around him right now are Democrats because the entire state government is controlled by Democrats?
Chris Sununu's done a pretty darn good job dating back to running for governor in 2016, of walking that tightrope of like supporting Trump, but then also being a moderate and going back and forth. It's not easy.
No.
As for specifically his reaction to impeachment, you know, every 2 weeks he meets with the executive council, and afterward he normally has he meets with reporters and takes their questions. Yesterday, Wednesday, when impeachment happened, he did not. And he does this. It wasn't the only case, but he did not have a news conference yesterday. So I don't know if he specifically weighed in yet on impeachment. But I also must be honest that I don't cover the State House anymore, so I wouldn't be the expert on that one.
Well, the only reason why the State House matters is again because the Democrats control the entire legislature, the Senate, and the House. He is really surrounded by Democrats that have pretty strong majorities. So he's got to run knowing that there is this base of support for Democrats. And while he may be at the top of the ticket, you also have Jean Shaheen running this time. And Jean Shaheen has been around forever. She's running for re-election as a U.S. senator. So to a large extent, he's between a Democratic sandwich.
Well, a good point. A very good point.
Yeah. All right. Paul Steinhauser, give us an exact description of what it is you do, who hires you, and why we need to pay attention to your site that sends out all this interesting stuff about polling information and who's on first and who's on second.
Well, I work full-time for about a year now for Fox News. I cover the 2020 race for them nationally, not just here in New Hampshire. So, and I, you know, I'm actually one of the ones that keeps them fair and balanced and cover the Democrats for them, the Democratic race. Here in New Hampshire, I write a couple times a week for the Concord Monitor, as well as Seacoast Online, and that's, of course, the Portsmouth Herald and Foster's Daily Democrat. And then I also do daily hits on Jack Heath's New Hampshire Today show, which is, I guess you'd call it a center-right morning talk show, pretty popular here. And then I do, as you mentioned, the 603, which is this weekly newsletter takes an in-depth look at the race for the White House here in the First Nation primary state. So we got a lot going on.
Well, thank you so much. We have a lot going on, and I always enjoy doing it with you. So, Paul Steinhauser, it is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you in 2020.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone, have a great end of the year. You bet. Change.